This is Reader's Radar, scanning Indiana's literary journals for outstanding new short stories. In every episode, we talk with one journal's editor about these surprising publications, and you hear a short story recommended by that editor as something special. Reader's Radar is a production of Indiana Public Media and WFIU Public Radio. It's your forecast for great reading ahead. I'm your host and reader, Shane Lauder. Most literary journals in the U.S. are produced by colleges and universities. Students apply to be on the editorial staff, and a faculty advisor guides the process. Ball State University in Muncie, Indiana, goes a somewhat different route. Their nationally distributed journal, The Broken Plate, is produced by one undergraduate class over the course of each semester, with the instructor acting as both editor and faculty advisor. That class is English 489, Practicum in Literary Editing and Publishing, and the resulting journal is The Broken Plate. Mark Neely is the instructor for English 489 at Ball State. Mark, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Is it fair to say the Broken Plate journal and the practicum class sort of came to life together, with each one being a reason for the other's existence?
Definitely. When I took over as faculty advisor of the Broken Plate, it was a very small student-run journal. It was run by volunteer editors. So I started the class as a way of giving those students in the class a lot of skills that they could use in future professions. And that's one thing that English department at Ball State and our creative writing program is very committed to, is guiding students, helping them develop skills that they can use. And we believe that, you know, the kind of skills they're developing both in their writing classes and in a class like the editing and publishing class, you know, are really going to be helpful to them as they navigate the job market. It's pretty rare that an undergrad would be working on a nationally distributed magazine. A lot of times they're working on just a university-wide journal. And so I think that really gives them a leg up when they go on the job market and they can point to skills they have developed in that class.
It's also really unusual, and I'm sure very inspiring for undergraduates to be reading contributions from writers like Roxane Gay. I'm wondering, how do you get writers of that stature to contribute?
First thing that we try to do is be very diligent about the way we run the magazine. We're very careful about things like copy, editing, proofreading, sending proofs to authors to make sure they approve what we're going to print, trying to make a good-looking product, trying to make our website accessible and nice looking. I think authors appreciate that. So I think we've drawn submissions from some pretty big names that way. We're really committed to making sure our authors know that we appreciate them and we're going to take good care of their work.
When did the journal actually begin?
I took over as faculty advisor in 2002. I guess at this point, it's almost 20 years old.
Wow. Is there a story about how Broken Plate got its name?
There is. The origin story of the name is that the original editors had decided to start this magazine. They were sitting in a coffee shop trying to figure out a name. They had made a long list of names. They weren't satisfied with any of them. And one of them knocked a plate off the table, it fell on the floor, and broke it. Someone just blurted it out, and that became the name.
That's great. Mark, take us through a year of English 489.
In the fall, they read submissions, learn about literary magazine culture, learn about the history of literary magazines, and usually by the beginning of winter break, they've chosen all the material for the issue. And then in spring, we come back and quickly as possible put the issue together, do all our proofreading, send out proofs to authors. It usually comes out in March, and we release it at our in-print festival of first books, which is a literary festival on the campus of Ball State.
How did that choice come about to really put a spotlight on first-time writers?
That idea comes from our partnership with the Imprint Festival of First Books, which is also run by Ball State's Creative Writing Program. And the idea behind that festival is that we invite three writers who have just published a first book to campus. They come and talk about what it means to publish a book. And it really is nice for the students because that's someone who they can sort of project themselves onto and say, you know, what is it going to take for me to publish a first book? And the Broken Plate really wanted to help publicize that festival and also give those first-time authors a little more exposure through doing interviews. We always run some of their work in the issue. That's one of the most exciting things I think we do as literary editors is help people early in their careers. Very exciting, obviously, to have your first story published or your first poem.
Well, let's get into the story that you have recommended for us today. This is The Checkup by William Ade. Why are you excited about this story?
Oh, for a lot of reasons. One thing I really admire is a true short story, very tightly written. And the thing that sort of leapt out at me very first about this story is the dialogue and character development. In a very short time, you get these two characters who are beautifully developed. They both have their own voice, and that's not an easy thing to do, and it seems to be done almost effortlessly in this story.
Is this a new author?
I don't think he's published a lot. I know that he came to writing somewhat later in life, so that's another thing that's exciting for us, too, when we get to publish the writing of someone who's come to writing a little later. You know, I think that's great for our students, too, that connecting across the generations like that is really important.
In a moment, we'll hear two short stories from The Broken Plate, The Checkup by William Ade and Joanna Flies with the Umbrella Man by Olivia Bazzacco. IndianaPublicMedia.org is your online station for award-winning news and timeless music, and for stories on the dazzling creativity everywhere in the Hoosier State. Scroll down on our About page for links to archive stories about publishing and interviews with authors of every genre. Hear poetry from Indiana on The Poet's Weave at IndianaPublicMedia.org. And now, two short stories from The Broken Plate. First, The Checkup by William Ade. The young woman tapped the desk with the end of her pen as the telephone sounded in her ear. She inhaled when a man answered, mindfully assuming her receptionist's speaking voice.
Hello, is this Mr. McCory?
Yes, it is.
Hi, this is Eileen from Dr. Rosenblum's office. I'm calling to confirm your scheduled checkup.
The man said nothing, emitting only an enigmatic chuckle. She was surprised by his reaction. Most people sighed and asked about available dates. His behavior was annoying. She had a dozen phone calls to make. The insurance companies were abusing her with their small print. She didn't have time to play guessing games.
Mr. McCory, can I confirm your appointment?
I don't think I'll need to see Dr. Rosenblum.
Oh, are you leaving our practice?
Not really. I don't need dental care.
Are you sure? I see where Dr. Rosenblum was tracking your gingivitis.
She heard him drawing a deep inhalation,
guessing he was about to deliver a profound announcement.
Her intuition was spot on.
I've pancreatic cancer.
Oh, no.
It's a pretty ravenous case. In 2 months, I won't be using my teeth for anything.
She instinctively grasped her throat, attempting to soothe the sensation of burning embarrassment.
Gosh, I'm so sorry. I didn't know.
Of course you didn't know. No need to apologize.
I'm so sorry.
You know something, Eileen? I never liked going to the dentist. The process of sitting in that chair while he dug around in my mouth was excruciating. Now, I know this sounds perverse, but never again going to the dentist is a great feeling. There was a pause. You want to know something crazier? Most people in my situation grab hold of the things they treasure. They spend time with family or travel to exotic places. Other folks bury themselves in spirituality. Not me. I may be nuts, but I'm celebrating all the things I'll no longer have to do. I'll never have to suffer through another colonoscopy prep or national election. No more being stuck in traffic. I don't have to worry about climate change. There's so much I won't have to endure anymore that dying doesn't sound half bad.
She looked around the office, hoping Dr. Rosenblum might walk through so she could hand off the call. She was only 20 years old. Working in this office was her first job. She wasn't a crisis counselor. What did her humanity demand in such a situation?
I don't know what to do, she said.
The panicky tone of her voice was embarrassing. She worried the caller would think she wanted to be done with him and his dreadful circumstances. She felt terrible knowing that was precisely her desire.
There's nothing you can do other than listen to my blathering.
I can pray for you,
she said, surprising herself.
She wasn't a churchgoer of any magnitude, but somehow offering to pray seemed appropriate. Wasn't that what you're supposed to do when everything's desperate and horrifying? The man's voice flared. That's another thing I won't miss. The absolute laziness of prayer. People say they'll pray for you. What does that mean? Are they no longer obligated to do anything for you because they spent 2 seconds mumbling with their eyes closed? She pulled the phone from her ear, her face hot from indignation. She didn't appreciate the sharp tone of the man's response. I was only trying to be decent, Mr. McCory. She no longer cared if she came across as unfeeling. The caller's breathing grew into a storm swell of heaving and releasing. I'm sorry, Eileen. I don't mean to be a jerk. Do you have any family to help you? My family hates me, and I hate them. Well, I'm sorry. Oh, good God, Eileen, stop saying you're sorry. There's no need for you to apologize. I think I better hang up. Whatever I say upsets you. No, please, not yet. The young woman closed her eyes, drawing in a deep breath. She could do this. She would focus all her energy on listening. She wouldn't speak. Maybe he'd burn off his torment if she just allowed him to talk, uninterrupted. That might do it. She could then end the call and feel like she'd behaved humanely. Are you still there? He said. Yes, sir. I'm still here. I'm afraid of dying, he said, his voice now a whisper. I'm trying to beat my fears into submission by acting like I don't care, but I'm failing at it. The man's confession surrendered to a fit of sobbing. I'm so alone. I'm so alone. She emptied her lungs and dropped her head. She'd never dealt with a dying man crying his eyes out. She was just the damn receptionist. What was she supposed to do? I made so many mistakes in my life, he said. I was a bastard, spreading my misery like a poisonous gas. I killed every relationship I ever had, and now I got no one to care about me. She heard him pulling in air with desperate, wet gulps. She bit hard on her lip. She would not tell him she felt sorry. My loneliness is another thing I won't miss. I'll no longer have to expend energy pretending I'm indifferent to being alone. She left his words unanswered, waiting patiently as his crying subsided. His breathing slowed, taking on a less hysterical rhythm. He sounded physically exhausted, his angry self-pity spent. I have an opening for next Wednesday afternoon. Would 2:30 be good for you? She knew the proposal didn't make sense. Mr. McCory would soon be taking his nourishment through a vein. Maybe she was offering nothing more than a token human connection, but it was the only thing she had to give him.
Okay, next Wednesday, he said, his voice a rasping whisper. Yeah, I can be there at 2:30, Eileen. 2:30 is good.
That was The Checkup by William Ade. William Ade lives in Burke, Virginia with his wife and Rudy the Cat. He calls his evolving literary voice Midwestern Old Man because he grew up in Indiana during the 50s and 60s. His stories have appeared in the Crimson Leaf Review, The Rind Literary Magazine, The Broken Plate, Black Fox Literary Magazine, and Literally Stories. Now, Joanna Flies with the Umbrella Man by Olivia Bazzacco. On Monday, Joanna looks out the window and sees a man flying in the air with an umbrella. Mother, she calls. Father, do you see this? See what, Joanna? They say. Come back here and pray the rosary. Joanna leaves the large window and sits back on the couch. All the lights are off, but it's not dark yet. The sun has another hour before it starts to go down. Light the candles, my sweet, they say to Joanna. She obliges and goes over to the mantel and reaches up on tiptoe to light the candles surrounding the Blessed Mother. Out the window, Joanna can still see the man whirling through the air. I think a tornado is coming, Joanna says. No, Joanna, they say. Tornadoes do not hit here. Now sit back down so we can get started. Niles had one, Joanna says. That's only 45 minutes away. That was 28 years ago, Joanna, they say. This week we'll do the Sorrowful Mysteries. I hate the Sorrowful Mysteries, Joanna says. That's enough out of you, Joanna, they say. Jesus would be offended if he heard you say that. I'm sorry. Sorry is not enough, they say. You remember what we've gone over? Joanna looks out the window. I guess. The Lord would take one look at you and curse you like the fig tree, her parents say. He would find no fruits on you. If you cannot produce fruits, Joanna, what purpose do you have here?
I don't know, Joanna says.
The umbrella man swoops low, then rises. Exactly. You would be just another pitiful, cursed fig tree. Think about that, they say. We do not need any more cursed fig trees in the world. Now it's time for the rosary. Joanna sits down and follows her parents' lead. She wonders if the other kids in the neighborhood do this too. She cannot be the only one praying the rosary every evening. She wonders if the neighborhood kids are cursed fig trees. The first sorrowful mystery, the agony in the garden, her parents say. Her mother takes the first decade. Joanna trudges along, and her parents ask her to lead the second decade, like they do every night. She stares hard at her rosary beads, trying to stay as focused as she can, trying to forget about the umbrella man outside. But when Joanna accidentally looks up, umbrella man is closer to the window than before. She loses her place, and they all sit in awkward silence.
Don't you see that?
Joanna asks her parents again. Jesus Christ! Hear our prayer, they chant immediately, in an attempt to fix Joanna's cursing.
He's flying!
Joanna, please.
Just look!
Her parents sigh, go over to the window, and look outside. They stare right at Umbrella Man. She can see his reflection in their eyes. Joanna feels triumphant, if only for a moment. There's nothing out there, Joanna. She blinks.
What?
Not a thing. Joanna knows they're lying. She watched their eyes following the Umbrella Man. They draw the blinds and sit back down. Now, let us start over. Joanna starts her decade over and tries to forget about Umbrella Man. She runs her fingers over her rosary beads, rolling each bead individually while thinking, one bead closer, one bead closer. On Tuesday, Umbrella Man is still there. The weatherman predicts gusty conditions all week. Joanna and her friends Henry and Sadie sit on the fence in her backyard, which divides it from the old decaying cornfield. They look up at the sky and watch Umbrella Man whirl around for hours.
How do you think he got up there?
Henry asks. Sadie hands her binoculars to Henry.
Oh, magic or something, she says.
I want to fly like that, Joanna finds herself saying. Henry and Sadie look at her.
What if we did?
Sadie's eyes are wide.
We have lots of umbrellas at my house.
Oh, my dad has a golf umbrella,
Henry adds. The church bells ring five times in the distance. Almost on cue, the sliding glass door opens and Joanna's mother and father appear. It is time for dinner, my sweet, they say. And Henry and Sadie scurry off, hoping not to be seen. Joanna leaves the fence and goes inside for dry fish and day-old bread. At 6 p.m., Joanna resumes her spot on the couch for the rosary. Her parents close all the blinds so Joanna will not get distracted. But Joanna cannot stop thinking about the possibility of flying with the Umbrella Man. The air must feel so good up there, miles high, his body ceaselessly whisking around. Joanna takes the second decade, as she does every night, and turns to face her parents, not like she does every night.
Do you think we can fly like Umbrella Man?
Joanna asks. Flying is impossible, Joanna.
Well, couldn't Jesus fly?
No. Her parents answer too quickly, as they usually did when someone got their facts wrong. He walked on water, my sweet. There was no flying. Jesus didn't need to fly to be holy. Oh, you're smarter than this, Joanna, they say. You cannot be asking such things when you get into St. Christine's. Joanna tries not to flinch. Her parents had been set on her attending the St. Christine Convent School for Young Girls for years. Now that she's older, her parents are more adamant about it than ever. Next time, her parents say, pray to St. Joseph of Cupertino first, before you go blaspheming to others. Now, the second sorrowful mystery, the scourging at the pillar. At 8 p.m., Joanna is sent to bed. She thinks about the Umbrella Man. It's still windy, the whole house creaking back and forth. She hadn't dared lift up the blinds after the rosary was done. She would have been scolded, probably sent to bed without dinner, probably instructed to pray 50 Hail Marys. But now her parents are asleep.
The wind continues to howl. She knows the Umbrella Man is still out there. She slides out of bed and lifts up the blinds ever so carefully, looking. The Umbrella Man is farther out than before. He twists and whirls in the wind, his free hand keeping his hat on his head. He doesn't make a sound. Joanna puts on her shoes and coat, grabs an umbrella, and tiptoes down the stairs, inches the sliding glass door along ever so quietly, making sure it doesn't squeak or groan. She succeeds and stands outside in the warm wind. She goes out in the backyard near the fence that divides her house from the old cornfield. She opens her umbrella, certain that once it fans out, she too will fly like Umbrella Man. Joanna struggles to get the umbrella open while the wind fights her, and the umbrella gives into the wind, turning inside out, completely ruined. "God damn!" Joanna says, and flinches for a moment. Since her umbrella plan failed, she doesn't know how to go about catching the Umbrella Man now. This was as far as she had planned. She stays where she is and continues to watch him move about, getting further and further away. Soon he's gone. And all that remains is the moon and Joanna. Joanna keeps watch a little longer to see if he'll come back. Umbrella Man does not come back. The moon dims and everything goes dark. Joanna kicks her broken umbrella and goes back inside. On Wednesday, by the time Joanna's family reach the third decade of the Sorrowful Mysteries, there's a knock on the door. Joanna's parents abruptly stop, jolting their bodies as if they have been greatly disturbed.
"I'll get it!"
Joanna practically jumps off the couch and runs out of the room.
"Joanna!"
Sadie and Henry say as she opens the door.
"Did you see?"
Joanna nods. She knows they're talking about Umbrella Man. He returned only hours ago.
"We're gonna catch him,"
Henry says, holding up butterfly nets.
"Come with us. He's right in your backyard."
"I can't," Joanna says. "I'm praying the rosary." Sadie sighs.
"Nobody prays the rosary anymore, Joanna."
"I know."
"Well, sorry, Joanna,"
they say, and take off. She closes the door and returns to the couch.
"Who was it, my sweet?"
her parents ask.
"My friends are trying to catch Umbrella Man."
"Heathens," they say.
"It looks like fun,"
Joanna says.
"It's not." "Why can't I go? I pray every day."
"You cannot go because you put God first," they say. "Your friends do not."
"But Henry goes to church,"
Joanna tries to fight back. "His church does not count."
"But cast not your pearls before swine."
Joanna looks at the floor.
Now, the third sorrowful mystery, the crowning with thorns.
Joanna tries to pray along, but she can hear her friends shouting in the cornfield in her backyard. They must be getting close to catching Umbrella Man. Joanna's certain of it. Joanna hears her friends leaving the cornfield. Henry shouts at her house,
"We flew, Joanna! We flew with the Umbrella Man! Sorry you missed it! We'll have fun praying and stuff!"
And Joanna's parents halt the rosary. "Why did we stop?" Joanna asks. "Your friends are a nuisance," they say. "They are liars and sorcerers. We cannot pray in these conditions." Joanna lets out a groan.
"Can't we just get to Jesus dying already?"
Her parents gasp. "Think about all the Son of God has done for you, Joanna. He wept for you, Joanna. He gave his life so that we might live."
"I didn't mean it,"
Joanna says. "I was just trying to be funny. I bet Jesus liked funny things."
"He didn't."
"Oh." They sit in silence for a moment, and her parents pick up where they left off. Joanna goes to bed at 8 p.m. and once again waits for her parents to fall asleep before she returns outside again with another umbrella. This one is much bigger than the one the wind destroyed last night, so Joanna is certain this time she will fly. If her friends could do it, surely she could. When Joanna opens the umbrella, it does not break. She feels the force of the winds that tries to yank the umbrella out of her hands, but she holds on tight. Nothing happens. Joanna thinks maybe she needs to get a running and jumping start. She crosses to the other side of the fence and begins to run faster and faster. And when she thinks she has enough speed, she jumps with all her might. She closes her eyes when she's in the air, waiting for the wind to pick her up and away. And for a moment, she feels like she's done it, certain she is flying. Joanna thuds back to the ground. The shock of not flying slackens her grip on the umbrella, and the wind takes it far away from her. On Thursday, Joanna asks her parents to take her to the library. I want to look at some books on the saints, Joanna recites. Her parents smile and touch her shoulders. Of course, Joanna. You're growing up so fast. When they get to the library, Joanna grabs an armful of books on the saints and turns to her parents. I'm going to go read these by myself, if that's okay. Go ahead, my sweet. Joanna takes off and gets as far away as she can and heads immediately over to the books on flying. Maybe she can learn something on flying from these books. Joanna spends hours flipping through the books and learns nothing. They're too advanced for her to understand. She tries harder by using a dictionary, but the process is too slow. Doing a project for school, Joanna? She turns her head and sees Father Whittle, the priest at her church, standing behind her. She almost didn't recognize him in normal clothes. Joanna loves Father Whittle. He isn't like her parents. He's a fun priest who would casually have a tambourine when the church sang the closing song and high-five children when he walked down the aisle when Mass was over. He's someone who believed in everyone. He even told all the children they could be whatever they wanted when they were older, if they trusted in the Lord. Joanna likes that confidence. Joanna's face lights up. I'm learning how to fly like the Umbrella Man. Father Whittle's face changes. People can't fly, Joanna. Joanna doesn't answer. She feels her insides sink. And don't waste your life on silly things, Father Whittle says. God gave you incredible knowledge. It would be a shame to waste it so carelessly. But have you considered attending St. Christine's? Joanna drops her head and stares at her flight books. Yes, Father. You'd do so well there, he says. And it would be a shame to ruin your chances so early. Now run along. I'm sure your parents are looking for you. Father Whittle strolls away, and Joanna is left utterly alone. Out of frustration, she throws the flight books on the floor and slowly flips through the book Patron Saints for the Blessed, not looking at the pictures or the words. She probably knows it all anyways. It's all she knows. When they pray the rosary that night, Joanna doesn't pay attention to the Umbrella Man, even though she can see his silhouette through the blinds. She dutifully takes over the second mystery like she always does. They make it to the fourth sorrowful mystery, the carrying of the cross. Joanna's parents look at her the way they do when she knows they want to talk about St. Christine's. Joanna, they say, we have been doing some thinking. Joanna looks to her parents. They sit in their rocking chairs with stiff backs. We think it's finally time to get started on your enrollment. You've grown up so much this year and are devoted to your religion. Joanna assumes they talked to Father Whittle at the library. Her parents continue. Nothing would please us more than if you attended the St. Christine Convent School for Young Girls. I don't want to, she says silently. Speak up, my sweet. That school is boring. Joanna tries to control her voice. It's like church, but forever. One of the sisters will be stopping by to talk to you tomorrow. Father Whittle will be here, too. We're hoping you can fill the last spot and be on your way within the month. But what about my friends? Joanna tries not to cry. I like my friends here. Our Lord and Savior is your friend, and he is someone you can always trust in and talk to. But he's not even here. You're just afraid, my sweet. Let us finish our prayers. After the rosary is complete, Joanna's parents guide her to her room, where they turn off the lights and instruct Joanna to pray 50 Our Fathers and go straight to bed. You need some alone time, they say. Get some rest. Tomorrow we hand the reins over to the Lord. They close the door. Joanna throws herself on her bed and doesn't pray the 50 Our Fathers. Instead, she rubs the corner of her blanket between her fingers and listens to the wind outside. When her parents go to bed, Joanna packs a small bag and goes outside with another umbrella. She watches Umbrella Man and tries to mimic his movements. She spends hours running and jumping, falling. Her hair entangles and her shoes getting muddy. She does not give up. She runs, she jumps, she lands. She runs, she jumps, she lands. On Friday, Father Whittle arrives early to Joanna's house. Sister Mary Agnes knocks on the door at 1 p.m., and her parents let her inside. They wear their Sunday best. Joanna also wears her Sunday best. She had known it was pointless to put up a fight. She shakes Sister Mary Agnes's hand and says, "Hello," as politely as she can. Father Whittle sits between Joanna and her parents. Sister Mary Agnes doesn't talk to Joanna much, but rather talks about the school, boarding, activities in which Joanna will be participating. We have knitting on Mondays, Sister Mary Agnes says.
Rosary bead crafting on Tuesdays. Wednesdays we have ice cream with the poor. Thursdays are for good deeds for those below us. Fridays are a day of fasting and prayer. Saturdays and Sundays are filled with masses and choir rehearsals. Your daughter would be expected to attend all of these activities and more if she is accepted. Joanna likes that if factor, and how much emphasis Sister Mary Agnes puts on the if, because she knows it means a chance that she will not get into the school, and she likes to see her parents' eyes dart around the room and try to keep a smile on their faces. "We discipline our girls right off the bat," says Sister Mary Agnes. "We don't tolerate any cuddle cuties in our school." "We can assure you Joanna is the perfect match for St. Christine's," Joanna's parents say. "Christine happens to be her middle name."
"No, it's..."
"Joanna, please wait until we're done talking," her parents say. Sister Mary Agnes raises her eyebrows, but doesn't look at Joanna's parents.
"Yes, well, fill out the application and we'll be in contact with you."
She turns to face Joanna.
"Do you have anything to say, Miss Joanna? This is a big decision, you know."
Joanna's parents stare at her. She listens for Umbrella Man for guidance, but is left with Father Whittle placing a heavy hand on her shoulder. Joanna looks at Sister Mary Agnes.
"No, ma'am."
Sister Mary Agnes leaves, and Joanna's parents spend the next 4 hours working on her application with Father Whittle. The Umbrella Man spins in circles. That night, when they make it to the fifth and final sorrowful mystery, the crucifixion, Joanna's parents have her put out the candles before beginning. The wind does not let up. They make it through the entire rosary in one sitting. Joanna's parents kiss her on the forehead and tell her they are proud of how well she did today. "Your future shines bright, my sweet," they say. Joanna is sent to her room to begin packing. She doesn't even know if she's made it into school yet, but her parents stay optimistic. And after her parents are asleep, Joanna takes the last umbrella in the house and sits on the backyard fence. She doesn't move for hours, only watches Umbrella Man and doesn't try to think about how he got up there. The dead cornfield runs into the dark. Joanna has trudged through the field many times before, but she always stops where it ends. Joanna opens the umbrella and begins to walk. The dead corn stalks crunch beneath her. When she tires of walking, she runs. She jumps. She lands. Umbrella Man moves with her. She runs. She jumps. She lands. She hits the edge of the cornfield and continues to jump. She's out of the neighborhood, and she continues to jump. She doesn't know where, and she continues to land. Umbrella Man keeps his lead, and Joanna mentally prays a Hail Mary out of fear, but quits halfway through. She runs. She jumps. She lands. She runs. Jumps. Lands.
That was Joanna Flies with the Umbrella Man by Olivia Bazzacco. Olivia Bazzacco earned both a BFA and an MFA in creative writing from Bowling Green State University in Bowling Green, Ohio. She served as assistant fiction editor for the literary magazine Mid-American Review. She has poetry and prose published in Electric Serial, Zaum, Jenny Magazine, and Prairie Margins. She currently teaches writing and literature courses at the College of the Albemarle in North Carolina. The Checkup by William Ade and Joanna Flies with the Umbrella Man by Olivia Bazzacco were published in The Broken Plate from Ball State University in Muncie, Indiana.
You've been listening to Reader's Radar, a presentation of WFIU Public Radio and Indiana Public Media, recorded at the studios of WFIU Public Radio on the campus of Indiana University in Bloomington, Indiana. Our producer is Shane Lauder. Production director is Mark Chilla. Digital director is Ayabon Binder. Executive producer is John Bailey. Music for this program is shared under Creative Commons license by the artists Lobo Loco, Arne Bang Hoosabee, Ask Again, and Maidan at freemusicarchive.org. Episodes are posted at our website, indianapublicmedia.org/readersradar, with links to more literary audio from WFIU Public Radio. I'm your host and reader, Shane Lauder. Keep listening, keep reading, keep an ear on the radar.